ISKCON founder Acharya Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Mahakoti Vaishnavinda ki jai. Nam Acharya Srila Haridas Thakur ki jai. Praying Shikal Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Adwaita Gadadhar Shri Vasadi Gaura Bhaktivinoda ki jai. Shri Shri Radha Krishna Gaura Gopinath Swami Kunda Radha Kunda Giri Govardhan ki jai. Vrindavan Dham ki jai. Tura Dham ki jai. Navadvip Mayapur Dham ki jai. Navadvip Puri Dham ki jai. Gangamaya Jumuna Devi ki jai. Bhakti Devi ki jai. Tulsi Maharani ki jai. Samaveta Bhakti Vrinda ki jai. Gaura Premkunde. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasaya Bhutale. Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namane Namaste Saraswati Devi. Gauravani Pacharani Nivasesa Sinivani Paskatyavi Satarani. Bandeham Sri Guru Sri Yuta Parikamalam Sri Guru Vaishnavam Sacha. Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatham Pitam Stam Sajivam. Sadvaitam Sadvadutam Parijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Deva. Sri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Sri Vishakam Vitam Sacha. Vanchanapati Vishra Gibson Vivatam Vitam Pavanevi Vaishnavam.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
June 7th, 2017, in Denver, Colorado, reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 13, The Appearance of Lord Varaha, Text 11. Satvam Masyam Apachyani. Sadrishan Yatmano Gunai. Utpadya Shasha Dharmena. Gam Yajnai Purusham Yaja. Stop.
Therefore, that obedient son,
Twam, as you are,
Asyam,
in her,
Apachyani,
children,
Sadrishani,
equally qualified,
Atmanaha,
of yourself,
Gunai,
with the characteristics,
Utpadya,
having begotten,
Shasa,
rule,
Dharmena,
on the principles of devotional service,
Gam,
the world,
Yajnai,
by sacrifices,
Purusham,
the Supreme Personality of Godhead,
Yaja,
worship.
Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada.
Since you are my very obedient son, I ask you to beget children qualified like yourself in the womb of your wife. Rule the world in pursuance of the principles of devotional service unto the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and thus worship the Lord by performances of yajna. Purport. The purpose of the material creation by Brahma is clearly described herein. Every human being should beget nice children in the womb of his wife as a sacrifice for the purpose of worshipping the Supreme Personality of Godhead in devotional service. In the Vishnu Purana 3.8.9, it is stated, Brahma Shrama Charavata Purushena Parapuman Vishnur Aradate Panta Nanyatato Shakarmana. Prabhupada's giving the translation to that verse. Quote, one can worship the Supreme Personality of Godhead Vishnu by proper discharge of the principles of Varna and Ashrama. There is no alternative to pacifying the Lord by execution of the principles of the Varnashram system. Unquote. Vishnu worship is the ultimate aim of human life. Those who take the license of married life for sense enjoyment must also take the responsibility to satisfy the Supreme Personality of Godhead Vishnu, and the first stepping stone is the Varnashram Dharma system. Varnashram Dharma is the systematic institution for advancing in worship of Vishnu. However, if one directly engages in the process of devotional service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, it may not be necessary to undergo the disciplinary system of Varnashram Dharma. The other sons of Brahma, the Kumaras, directly engaged in devotional service unless they had no need to execute the principles of Varnashram Dharma. Satvam Ashyama Patyani Sadrishar Yatmano Gunai Utpadya Shasadarmena Gamya Gunai. Since you are my very obedient son, I ask you to beget children qualified like yourself in the womb of your wife. Rule the world in pursuance of the principles of devotional service unto the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and thus worship the Lord by performance of yajna. So Prabhupada starts off here with the purpose of the material creation, and he has in the last paragraph of the purport also the ultimate aim of human life. So this is a common question of the human being. Why am I here? What am I doing here? What's my purpose? What am I supposed to do? What am I supposed to accomplish? Yet, I think practically speaking, every human child asks this question. Why am I here? Where did I come from? What am I doing here? What am I supposed to do? And people talk a lot about, you know, finding their calling, finding their mission in life, finding their purpose in life. We spoke a lot on Sunday about how doing work that has meaning. But without a concept of meaning, we're not very happy people, isn't it? If you think what I'm doing is meaningless, it doesn't mean anything, it doesn't have any purpose, it doesn't have any goal. I mean, even when people engage in strictly leisure activities, it has some purpose, doesn't it? They're trying to relax, they're trying to have fun, they're trying to bond with their friends. There's some goal, there's some purpose. So is there an overall purpose for creation? So nowadays, many people are taught that there's no overall purpose for creation. They're taught that life is simply a combination of chemicals, yes? The only origin of life is that somehow in some electrical storm, some chemicals combined. Randomly. Without any purpose. There was no intelligence. There was no brain. It just happened. And everything that we see in the world is a result of this just chance, random, purposeless happening. That we are simply these bodies, that we are simply a material thing, that our mind is simply our brain, that basically we're just matter. And everything is just matter with no particular purpose. Why does the universe exist? I don't know, it just exists. You know, I was talking with one agnostic, and I said, you know, can't you see that there must be intelligent, purposeful creation in life and in matter? And he said, well, no, if you had an infinite number of multiverses, multi-universes, and it was infinite, then it could just happen that we could have this situation where the planets are perfectly rotating, there's all these varieties of life. It could just happen. So that's what people are thinking. It's just some, there's no purpose. And of course, when people think there's no purpose, then they have no reason to live their life by any kind of code or any kind of, the whole concept of duty becomes absurd. There's no more duties anymore. I mean, when I first read Bhagavad Gita and Prabhupada kept talking about prescribed duties, I kept scratching my head. What's a prescribed duty? What does that mean? Who is scribing it? You know, where's the scribe writing this duty? Where did my duty come from? How do I have a particular duty? And Prabhupada starts off here, every human being should beget nice children in the womb of his wife. What a radical idea in 2017. I mean, that's completely radical, that people should have nice children in marriage. Isn't it? I mean, I think that's one of the most difficult aspects of what Prabhupada taught to try to convince anybody of. You should get married and you should have children in your marriage. I mean, that just seems so obvious. It seems like a natural biological fact of the whole living world. But people, no, I don't want to get married. I just want to be free to do whatever I want, to go to the clubs, right? To have relationships with as many people as I want. And children? I don't have children. So much responsibility and so much difficulty. Why would I want to have children? And this attitude also comes into our Hare Krishna movement. As Prabhupada said, Arjuna was very expert at using Krishna consciousness to avoid Krishna consciousness. Right? Arjuna was saying, but it says, I've heard from authorities, I'm not supposed to attack my elders. Right? So even in Krishna consciousness, we say, oh, no, I don't want to get married. Oh, I have a wife or a husband. What will happen to my sadhana? And what if I have children? Oh, that's the most terrible thing. And as I travel all over the world, people are like, children means forget your sadhana, forget your spiritual life. You know, if you really have to have one because you're so attached to sense gratification, all right. That's it. And there's this mood that's come from the outside society of just this irresponsible life. It's pervaded our Hare Krishna movement. And then we cover it up with this idea of sadhana renunciation. It's quite interesting. So what is the purpose of life? The purpose of life, Prabhupada says here, is to worship Vishnu. And to have a population of persons who are worshiping Vishnu. That's the purpose of the world. Of course, Prabhupada also says the purpose of the world is to satisfy our material desires. And therefore, we have the system given to us by the Lord of the Dharma, of Varna, and Ashrama. Okay, you want to enjoy the world, you want to satisfy your senses in the world, fine. Do it in such a way that you also worship Vishnu. And so for the vast majority of people, as in really the vast majority of people, Prabhupada starts with this every human being, so the vast majority of people should worship the Lord through the dharmas of varna and ashrama. And then we achieve our purpose. But of course, there are some human beings, as Prabhupada mentions here, who don't need to worship the Lord through varna and ashrama. They can worship the Lord through the 64 angas of bhakti only, and not through varna and ashrama. All right, so what is varna and ashrama? And how do we do it as a service to the Lord? And how could we also directly worship the Lord without varna and ashrama? So varna and ashrama basically means stuff we're already doing naturally, biologically, in some form or another. So let's look first at ashrama. Ashrama deals with four stages. And if you live long enough, they pretty much happen to everybody. You're a kid, you're in the prime of life, you're in middle age, and you're old. Yes? Does that pretty much happen to everybody, unless you die young? And in most human societies, I'd say in all human societies, even the most simple, like the African pygmies, when you're a child, what do? You?
Play.
You play? What else do you do?
Study.
You study. In every human society, children are given an education. And they're given an education for what purpose? So they can do what?
Work.
They're given an education so that they can work. They also should be given an education so they can have proper human relationships. Although we often don't do that in our modern education. But traditionally, human beings, they would educate their children for their work, and they'd also educate their children how to behave properly as a human being. Then what do human beings do in their prime of life? They work. And what else do human beings do in their prime of life? They have children, or they have sexual relationships. Yes? Isn't this what happens? Yes? Am I correct? Human beings in their prime of life, they have two main interests, sex and money. Correct? Is that right? Yes. And then what happens in middle age? What happens to humans in middle age? They have a what? A midlife what?
Crisis.
Crisis. What does that mean? It means they look back on their life and they go, I don't know. I don't feel the same spark for my romantic partner. I'm not really that satisfied with my job anymore. Right? Weren't you telling me this about a professor? You know, I cared about so many things when I was 20 and 30, and then when I got to 40, I cared a little less, and once I got to 50, I really just didn't care so much anymore. Of course, in modern society, when you have a midlife crisis, you think, oh no, that means I need a new romantic partner and a new career, so I can reset to age 20. Try again. But the natural proclivity in middle age is to retire, to say, I'm done. I don't really have much interest anymore in family life. I don't have much interest anymore in career. The sex and money thing has gotten old. And a lot of people in retirement, what do they do? What do retired people typically do?
Travel.
Yes? I remember my parents going on boat cruises. They went to the Panama Canal, and they went to Egypt, and they went to Alaska. But they generally travel. And they also turn over the business, the job, to the younger generation, the family. Right? They get their children married, and they turn over everything to them, and they retire, and they generally travel. And then what happens when you get old? What are you doing then? You're preparing for what? For death. Like my oldest grandson's getting married, Krishna willing, in a year. And I said, well, you know, if I'm in this body and ambulatory, then I'll come. And he said, don't say that, Grandma. I said, that's my life. He said, you can't help it when, you know, your friends, you know, every week some friend or relative of yours is dying. Isn't it? You know, every week, sometimes more than one. And it's just there. just there every single day. You're thinking, I wonder if this is going to be it. Which, you know, you really don't think like that so much when you're like 15. Generally speaking, maybe if you're really hardcore Hare Krishna. But, you know, generally it's not like that. And you're preparing for death. Now, in our modern society, what do people do when they prepare for death? They move into a what? Into a nursing home. They move into an old age home. Or basically, they're taking sannyas. You understand? They've given away all their possessions. Their family doesn't see them anymore. Believe me, in these old age homes, you're lucky if you see your family once a year. They lose communication with their family. They lose communications with their possessions. And they prepare for death. Of course, generally, they're just absorbed in watching TV, you know, or somebody doing an Elvis impersonation in the community room. But those life cycle things are already there. It's not that they're not there. It's not that the system of ashram is imposing something that's not already happening. And varna is already there. Some people are working in the field of ideas, some people are working in the field of government, some people are working in the field of resources, and some people are working in the fields of beauty and function. They're already doing this. You can already categorize everything that everybody's doing, other than criminal activities, into those four fields. So that varna and ashram, we talked about first ashram and then varna, is taking something that's already happening. But then it's adding the word what? Varna ashram, dharma. And we have this word in this verse, dharma. So the word dharma means the essence of something, the identity of something, the truth of something, say the purpose of something. So Krishna is saying, take what you're already doing to fulfill your material desires, what you're already doing just by biological nature, and do it as a dharma. To do it as a dharma. Now, if you're going to do something as a dharma, are you looking at principles or details? Principles. This is so important. What was that quote we found yesterday, Prabhupada, talking to Professor Kutoski? What did he say? Do you remember it exactly?
I don't remember it exactly, but he said it was not the old way.
He said, we're not trying to reinstitute the old way of Hindu culture. We're just trying to take the best from it, something like that. We're just trying to take the best idea from it. And Prabhupada was trying to teach the principles of varna and ashram. Not trying to copy-paste all the details of an old system, which doesn't exist anymore even in India, in its details. So let's look at some of these principles. What are the principles? We'll look first at the principles of varna. So one principle of varna is that you should work according to your
nature.
That what our nature is and what we do to earn a living should be linked. Did you find it? You just have to find it. So that's the first principle. And that's something I think most people would readily agree with. That they would love to have the way they earn a living be something that they really enjoy and they're really good at. Isn't that a fact? I think that's a principle of varna that we could immediately get agreement from people on. Then how do you know what your nature is? You know, there's a lot of controversy about how much of our nature is from our training and our circumstances, and how much of our nature is inherent. And anybody who comes from a family where there's more than one child, or anyone who's raised more than one child, knows that even in the same family, in the same circumstances, the children can be vastly different, correct? I mean, maybe nowadays people only have one or two children, it's not so obvious. But if people have a lot of children, four, five, six children, then you can immediately know. It's not just coming from the parents, and it's not just coming from the circumstances. There's something inherent in the person. And this is obvious from a very young age. So how do we know what our nature is? Well, if we look at Shastra, we can look at what makes our life rich. And we talked about this the other day. Did you find it?
Yes,
can you read it?
So this is a curse.
This is a conversation between Srila Prabhupada and Professor Katovsky in the Soviet Union. I believe it was June 22, 1971. Prabhupada says, "So our point is, we are not going to bring back the old type of Hindu society. It is not that." Our Professor Katovsky says, "It is impossible." Prabhupada says, "It is impossible. Our idea is that best ideas from the original idea."
Okay, thank you very much. So Prabhupada is not trying to do the impossible of bringing in the details, but the best idea from the original idea, the principle. Okay, so we talked about nature. How do we find our nature? So one aspect of our nature is, how do we feel rich? How do we feel rich? And the Shastra tells us there's six ways of being rich. What are the six ways of being rich?
Beauty.
You can be rich and have riches in beauty. You can have richness in knowledge. You can have richness in renunciation. You can have richness in strength, fame, and Aishwarya, which we normally translate as wealth, but it's related to the word Ishwara. So that's strength in controlling, in leadership, and also in wealth. So which of these are we attracted to? And not everybody is attracted to the same thing. There's a lot of people who don't really care about having beauty in their lives. I know, as I visit people's homes in various temples, that some people just don't care about beauty. Yeah, I remember one time in India, some devotees and I were visiting this one sannyasi, and the paint was peeling off the walls, and there was like one color, two different colored paints on the walls. And I said, "Maharaj, why don't you..." It was a small room also, very small room. I said, "Why don't you paint the wall?" He said, "I'm only here temporarily." I said, "How long have you been here?" He said, "Oh, about 8 years." So some people have no... It's just not a way that they want to make their life rich. Some people don't care much about money or leadership. We have different kinds of wealth that attract us. So that's some indication of our nature. And then, of course, we have our nature as the psychology of each of the four fields. Are we energized and excited by ideas, concepts, teaching, study, research? Are we energized by leadership and providing for people, making sure that people have enough food and water and a clean place to stay, and making sure that they're safe? Are we energized with the idea of working with the flow of resources, producing wealth for the society, producing wealth for ourselves? Or are we energized by the idea of making sure things work, doing some functional job, staying in the background and having some work that provides for the function of society, or doing something that adds to the beauty of society through the arts? What kind of thing makes us feel alive? And if you combine that, what field of work and what kind of opulence, you get a very good idea of one's nature. Then another principle of Varna is that nature has to be nurtured. That you have to be trained how to use your nature properly. You have to be trained just even to bring out your own nature. And you have to have people who can recognize your nature. Many, many times, parents and teachers criticize and try to repress the nature of a child. It's quite common. You know, it's really, really very common. So you have a child who's, you know, they know what everybody's doing. They're always aware of what everybody's doing. They can't focus on their own stuff, but they're focusing on everybody else's stuff. And whenever they see anything that's unfair, they want to go and fix it. And whenever they see that a rule isn't being followed, then they want to go do the rule. Well, what field is that? What field is that? Ideas, government, resources, or beauty function? Government. And this kid may be told his whole life, "Would you mind your own business? Quit trying to tell other people what to do, and quit trying to manage everything, and quit trying to have everything be fair. Would you just focus on your own algebra? So this is very, very common. Right? Like John Audubon, he would sit in school looking out the window at the birds. And what do you think his teacher said to him? Did they say, oh, this is wonderful. You're going to have a career with nature. No, what did they say? Do your work. Make sure you study American history. So an essential principle of Varna is training. This means people being able to recognize that every nature is beautiful and glorious if it's trained in the right way, to bring out the inherent nature of a child and to help them learn how to engage it in a positive way. Another principle of Varna is to aim for the fifth goal of life, prema, paramartha, mahan. That generally, we are aiming just for dharma, artha, kama, moksha. Generally, we're thinking, okay, I'm going to do my work. That's going to get me wealth in one or more of the six opulences. With the kind of opulences I want to enjoy, then I will satisfy my senses, my mind, and my ego. And when I get tired of it, I will take a break. And then after taking a break for a while, again, I do my work. And they just get in this cycle of dharma, artha, kama, moksha, dharma, artha, kama, moksha. So a principle of Varna is that don't just work for ordinary dharma, artha, kama, moksha, but work for the pleasure of the Lord. Yajnartha, kama, no, natra, loko, yavaka, karma, bandana, tadartha, karma, kontaya, mukta, sangha, samacha. That you should work for the pleasure of the Lord, to please the Lord. Another principle of Varna is be careful of the gunas. Be careful of the restrictive ropes of goodness, passion, and ignorance, which are all varieties of ego. The ego of sattva is, I'm a really ecologically aware, balanced person. I'm really forgiving and kind and equipoised. I'm not really very interested in the ordinary things of the world and the rat race. You know, I like to grow my own spinach, sit on a mountain and meditate. I'm above the fray of the world and I am equipoised within. And that's the ego of sattva. And then the ego of rajas is, I'm going to save the world! I'm going to give vast amounts of charity and build hospitals and schools and run countries and provide unlimited wealth for people and cure diseases and educate millions of people, and I'm going to be a great hero and I'm going to take care of my family and work very hard, and when I die there'll be a statue in the park in my name and people will come and worship me forever in history. And then ego in the mode of ignorance is, I'm going to do my work. I don't really care about trying to do something in the world. I'm just going to do my work. I'm a simple person. As long as I can do my work and have my beer and watch my football game, I'm happy. Yeah? Nice warm place to curl up and go to sleep. Yeah, I'm not like these other people. I'm ambitious and running after things. And I'm not like these new agey, hodgepodgey people. Yeah, just simple. You know, do my work, have my beer, my football game. My dog. This is the difference. And they're all ego. They're all, I am the center, I'm wonderful, the whole world is about my happiness. And the same tendency that pushes us towards a particular kind of field also predisposes us to be grabbed by a particular rope of ego. So another principle of Varna is that as we're working in our natural field, we have to do so without ego, without being captured by any of the ropes. We do so simply as a servant of the Lord. Because all of these ropes are ahankara vimutta makartaham iti manyate. And if we don't do it as a servant of the Lord, then shama evihi kevalam. It's all useless. You can perfectly do all of your varna and ashram duties, and it doesn't mean anything. Ashradhayavitam datam tapastatam kritam tayat. Asad ichutite partana chitab. If you're doing your varna and ashram with the ego of on the doer and on the enjoyer, it's all useless. As we talked about on Sunday, For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. Whatever good you think you do is balanced by something in the negative. There will always be equilibrium, and nothing is ever accomplished. It's just like the little hamster that I had as a child that ran around on a wheel. You've seen those? Right? They're just running. I'm getting somewhere. But you're not really. So therefore, one has to, the principle is to beware of the restrictive ropes. Don't act in the restrictive ropes, but act on the platform of egolessness. Act on the platform as a servant of the Lord. Another principle is that one should give in charity. That whatever one earns in whatever field and whatever opulence, one should not keep all for oneself. And hold that. We'll get back to it in a minute. Another principle is that one should engage in yajna. The work itself should be an offering to the Lord, but one should also do discreet, separate worship of the Lord. That every human being, every day, every week, periodically, should engage in some kind of worship of the Lord where all you're doing is worshiping the Lord, which is, of course, our sadhana. We do our sadhana every day, then we have special sadhana on Ekadasi, we have special sadhana on festival days, and so forth. There should be time put aside just to worship the Lord, as well as the work itself being a kind of worship. Another principle is that one should cherish one's field of work. One shouldn't be exploiting the sources of one's own wealth. If you're getting wealth from the land and the cows, you protect the land and the cows. If you're getting wealth from taxes or rent, you protect the citizens from whom you are taking the taxes. If you are getting wealth from the realm of ideas, you protect ideas against fraud and misinterpretation. If you're getting your wealth from the arts, you protect the arts. You keep them as a pure form to transmit truth rather than sensuality. If you're getting your wealth from the functions of society, then you also keep them something that reminds others of God. You don't just automate them and factoryize them and strip them of their satisfaction for both the people who engage in them and the people who use them. Whatever, you don't cut off the head of the goose that lays the golden egg. Right? Getting the golden egg, you also feed the goose. You take care of whatever is giving you wealth. Then you cherish also your wealth. Whichever of the six opulences you're enjoying, you also protect it. If you're enjoying renunciation, you protect renunciation. If you're enjoying power, you protect power. If you're enjoying money, you protect money. You're enjoying beauty, you protect money. You cherish it, you steward it. You use it in service. You don't just take it for yourself. You make sure it's being used in the service of the whole. So those are the basic principles. What was it? The best idea of the idea? These are the principles of Varna. The details, we're not going to be able to institute the details. Prabhupada said it was what?
Impossible.
If we get stuck on trying to institute the details, we will be doing something that Srila Prabhupada, who said that impossible is a word in the Fool's Dictionary, said that it was impossible. So if Prabhupada thought it was impossible, then I think it's actually impossible. Not only is it impossible, it's not even appropriate or wanted, because things, one of the items of knowledge is that things have to be applied according to time, place, and circumstance. So if we try to apply details of these principles of Varna to 2017, it would actually cause a disturbance. Now you notice that one of the principles of Varna was charity, was sharing one's wealth. Now when do we do our Varna again according to the life cycle? The second phase, in the prime of life. The students, retired and preparing for death people, don't do careers. Yes? Even in the world. Students, retired, and sannyas actually are supposed to be dead. You die before dying. Civilly dead. I know in the Madhva Sampradaya, they actually perform the funeral ceremony. I mean, they don't burn the body, obviously, but they as part of the sannyas initiation, they perform a funeral ceremony to die before dying, which is what kind of people do when they move into a nursing home before they die. They're kind of dying before dying, you understand? It's like a parody of it. They're letting go of their identity and giving everything away. And sometimes people are forced to die before dying if they have dementia or Alzheimer's. You lose your identity, isn't it? That's what death is. Death is a letting go of the identity of this life. I am Sam Smith, I have a beautiful wife and three daughters, and I'm an engineer. That's what you were losing at death. That identity. And people, some people say, they lose it by force of circumstances. They don't remember who they are. Hi, Mom, I'm your son. You're who? Who are you? Remember you used to make those wonderful... I used to do what? That is gone. Anyway, those people don't work. Students, retired, and dead people don't have careers. Yes? Am I correct? Okay. So the only people that Varna applies to are the grihasthas. And one of the main principles of Varna is charity. Whatever your form of wealth, beauty, strength, fame, knowledge, renunciation, whatever your field of work, ideas, government, resources, or beauty function, you're not supposed to keep it all to yourself. At least you're supposed to share it with a spouse. Therefore, Bhakti Vinod says, I wanted to earn money, and keeping in mind the laws of religion, I got a wife. So today we think, because I have a spouse, therefore I need to earn money. It's actually the opposite. Because you want to earn money, and it's not just earning money. It's a desire to work in the world, to have my psychophysical nature be active in the world. That desire, which tends to be very strong in the prime of life, isn't it? I want to do this thing for the world. I want to act in the world according to my nature. It's very, very strong. Just as strong as the biological sex drive. Very, very strong. So if one has this desire, okay, fine. Then at least you take care of a spouse. The concept that a person is single with their own apartment or house, having a job, and keeping all the money for themselves is not ashram dharma. And then who else are you supposed to share it with? Besides your spouse, at least your children, which is the essence of this, of what Prabhupada's saying here in this very, very radical second sentence. Every human being is supposed to have children. The concept that I'm not going to have children because it's going to cramp my style is not dharma. And that's true even if you're coating it with this little veneer of Krishna consciousness. Because the idea is, Krishna wants wonderful people in the society, and if you're going to take to that ashram, that's your duty. I mean, if you physically can't, you know, that's another thing. But that's your duty. The dharma of the grihastha ashram is to provide pious, honest wealth and good children for the society. That's their dharma. That's what they're giving to the society. And if they don't do that, if they intentionally don't do that, they're not doing their dharma. You know, the dharma of the brahmachari ashram is to study, not just to be cheap labor for the Hare Krishna movement. Sorry, I didn't say that, somebody else said that. Somebody behind me. But the dharma of the brahmacharis is to study. Now, some people want to study lifelong. You see this out in the world. People, they get, you know, one PhD after another, or they're always taking different courses. And they're doing postdoctoral research. You see this in some religious traditions, right? The cloistered monks and nuns, all they do is pray and study. They're lifelong in the brahmacharya ashram. That's unusual. The main idea is study. And generally, brahmacharya means preparation. Just like everywhere in the world, if you're a student, it means you're being prepared. Most people don't stay a student, so what are you being prepared for? You're being prepared for the grihastha ashram or?
Sanyas.
Well, sannyas is not, you don't usually jump brahmachari directly to sannyas sometimes. Vanaprastha, which is the bridge. Vanaprastha is the bridge between grahastha and sannyas, and it's the bridge between brahmacharya and sannyas for someone who skips the grahastha ashram. So what is the dharma of the vanaprastha ashram?
Austerity.
Why? Well, especially if you've come from the grahastha ashram, you want to get yourself detached from everything before you prepare for death. Particularly, you're trying to get detached from family and career. So you do austerities to intentionally detach them. And also, what do the vanaprasthas generally do? They generally live in the
forest.
In the vana, which Prabhupada says we can live in the Vrindavana. He says that Vrindavana Mayapur, particularly for those in the vanaprastha ashram. And what we see in our Hare Krishna movement is brahmacharis who don't enter the grahastha ashram. Very few of them really stay in the brahmacharya ashram, although we speak like that in our Hare Krishna movement. Most of them actually become vanaprasthas. They start taking responsibility not just to study, but to
teach.
And Prabhupada talks about the renounced ashram. He's combining the vanaprastha and sannyas ashram. And he's saying that he has gives them two main responsibilities. Anybody know for the vanaprasthas and the sannyasis? Teaching, and two forms of teaching.
Writing.
Writing and speaking. He says those that the renounced orders, they are for particularly writing and speaking, giving learned discourses and producing transcendental literature. So this is the main dharma of those in the vanaprastha and sannyas ashram, and particularly in the sannyas ashram, the dharma is purification of existence. One should become completely purified in order to prepare for death. Just like in brahmachari ashram, you're being prepared for life. Right? Brahmachari is a preparation for life, either as a grahastha or as a vanaprastha leading to sannyas. And sannyas is preparation for death. Right? I remember when sannyasi gave a class and asked why I wasn't there, and one of the devotees said, "Oh, she's going with one of the other women for a birth class." And then he said, I wasn't there, but he said, "This is nonsense. Why do you have to prepare for birth?" So I went up to his room later and I said, "Maharaj, do you have to prepare for death?" "Yes." He said, "Well, you also have to prepare for birth." So there's... And he said, "All right." I said, "Will you please publicly apologize and rescind that?" So he did. So the point is that each of these have some dharma. There's a dharma with our career, and there's a dharma with our place in the life cycle. And when we're doing these as a dharma, we're not just doing them, we're doing them as a dharma, then our life itself becomes an offering. As Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita 4:24, the person making the offering itself, the result, everything becomes Brahman. Everything becomes Brahman. But as we mentioned earlier, one also has distinct times specifically for making an offering. We don't just say, "Oh, because everything in my life is an offering of sacrifice to the Lord, therefore I don't need times to be with the Lord." That's part of the dharma. It's one of the principles of the dharma. The brahmacharis aren't just studying. They're also engaged in sadhana. The grahasthas aren't just distributing wealth and good population. They also engage in a sadhana. The vanaprasthas aren't just performing austerity. They engage in a sadhana. The sannyasis aren't just purifying their existence. They're engaged in a sadhana. There's discrete times when, okay, we're going to be engaged directly in sacrifice. Now, there are some people who don't need to engage in any of these dharmas of varna and ashram, even though, at the very least, they do go through the normal biological life cycle. Of course, the example given here of the Kumaras, they didn't even do that, did they? Did the Kumaras go through the normal biological life cycle? They stayed... What age were they?
Five.
Five is interesting because the Brahmacharya ashram usually starts at age?
Five.
They didn't even go there. You understand? They're Brahmacharis in the sense that they're celibate. But they never entered the Brahmacharya ashram, never entered any of the ashrams. They stayed at one side of the life cycle. I mean, in one sense, you could say you start studying as soon as you're conceived. There's some sort of preparation and study. But as far as an active time of study, it starts at age 5. They never started. So they didn't have a career, and they never went through the life cycle. They were outside, therefore, of any dharma. What dharma are you going to do? Do the brahmacharya ashram dharma.
I'm only 5. I didn't start school yet.
You know, there's no dharma to do. They're certainly not going to get married. And there's nothing to retire from. Right? So there are some persons, of course, biologically, they may not stay. So I'm just thinking, you know, sometimes people, it's happened to one of my sisters, sometimes people have a physiological condition where they never mature. You know this? My sister never naturally turned into an adult. Doctors gave her artificial hormones and things like that. And there's one child of our devotees who also had this medical condition. And Prabhupada told her parents, he said, this child was a very great yogi in a previous life. And the mother told me that she started laughing. And Prabhupada said, don't laugh. He said, I'm being serious. He said, actually, this child was a very accomplished yogi. So sometimes that happens. Of course, generally when that happens materially, people think it's a very terrible thing. But that a person has some situation where they don't go through the normal life cycles. But there are also some people who, even if biologically their body is changing from a child to an adult to middle age to old age, they don't engage in any of these dharmas. And if you don't engage in any of the dharmas of the life cycle, you also don't engage in any of the dharmas of varna, because varna is intimately connected with the grihastha ashram. Now, why would somebody do that? Why would somebody be outside of both career and the life cycle? Well, there'd have to be two reasons. One would be Krishna has a different kind of work for them to do. And the other is they don't personally need that process of purification. So even if I don't personally need the process of the dharma of the life cycle and the career, I might do them anyway as a example. Yadyadacharti shrestas. I might do it anyway as a service. And in fact, the Bhagavatam is full of this. Of liberated persons, they don't need to purify material desires because they don't have any. They don't need to go through a dharma of a life cycle. And they don't need to go through a dharma of a career. But Krishna wants them to set an example, and he wants them to do a particular job. Krishna might want a completely liberated soul to be a president of a country, or to be the head of a company, or to be the head of a drama troupe, or to be a professor in a university. Krishna might want a fully liberated soul to get married and have 10 children, like Bhaktivinoda Thakur. He might want a perfectly liberated soul to be a student or to be a traveling preacher. He might want perfectly liberated souls to set the ultimate idea example, because only the perfectly liberated souls are going to be able to follow the principles of varna and ashram perfectly. Does that make sense to everybody? If I have some kind of material contamination, then I'm not going to follow those dharmas perfectly. So how am I going to get an example of what is the ideal? Would have to be someone who's completely has no reason to do it. So Krishna wants that. And also maybe somewhat the desire of a jiva. The jiva may also just, I have no interest, and Krishna may approve. So it may come first from Krishna. Okay, you know, you can be outside of the varna and ashram, and it may come from the jiva. You know, I really don't want to be in the varna and ashram. Can I be outside? What are some examples we have in the Bhagavatam of people who were completely outside of the varnas and the ashrams, besides the four kumars? Jedbard. Who else? The Avadhuta Brahman. Who else? Yeah, Narayani. Sukadeva Goswami. The Python Man, yes. So we have examples in the Shastra. We have many examples of fully liberated souls who were acting in varna and ashram, like Prahlad Maharaj, where Lord Nisingadev says to him, I order you to be the king of the demons. Imagine that. Imagine getting that order. I order you to be the king of the demons. He got married, he had children, he was ruling. So. There are examples like that of, you know, there are examples of conditioned souls who go through the varna and ashram alongside their bhakti and bhakti-ize their varna and ashram so that there's no longer any difference spiritually in terms of potency between their direct sadhana and their spiritualized varna and ashram. We have that example. We have the example of people who got stuck in varna and ashram without bhakti, like Dhritarashtra, Bharat before, King Puchini Barishat, Agnidra. So we have examples in the Shastra of people who got stuck in varna and ashram and didn't spiritualize it. We have examples of people who spiritualized it so that you could no longer even distinguish in spiritual potency between direct sadhana and their varna and ashram. We have examples of people who are fully liberated and engaged in varna and ashram to set an example and have some purpose of the Lord. And we have examples of people like the four Kumars who are totally outside of varna and ashram. So in whatever category we're in, we shouldn't be in the category of people who are stuck in varna and ashram. Shama Eva Hikevala. We don't want to do that. We want to be at least in one of those other categories. I'm doing my varna and ashram as a service to purify myself alongside my main sadhana. Or I'm a liberated soul and I'm doing this to set an example, or I've been given permission by Guru and Krishna to be outside. But in any of those three options, Savaipum Samparo Dharma Yato Bhaktira Hotse Hoitukiya Pratita Yadama Supersi. If we want to be satisfied, we're not going to be satisfied by being a big filmmaker or a big business magnate or by milking cows or any of those things. We're only going to be satisfied if we connect everything with Krishna. That is our ultimate purpose. That is our purpose. That is our meaning, whatever we're doing. And therefore, we should ask ourselves always, who am I trying to satisfy? Who am I trying to satisfy? Who am I really serving? Am I serving my senses? Am I serving my ego? Am I serving a family member? Who am I serving? Who am I trying to satisfy? And if we are serving and trying to satisfy the Lord, then we will find satisfaction regardless of in which category we may be in. So, it's 9:06, I've gone over. I'm sorry, very bad.
We have a question online.
A question from online, okay.
Yeah, this is Ankit, Guru Bhakta Ankit.
Hare Krishna, Ankit.
He says, great talk. He has a humble question. Does regulations of any tradition, including Varnashram, mean that one needs to curb or suppress their inherent desires?
Any tradition. There are some traditions that curb one's nature. Those traditions are the Nirvisesha Sunyavadi traditions, particularly the Sunyavadi traditions. So the traditions that preach that ultimately there is nothing, that ultimately we do not exist, that even seeing ourselves as the observer is an interim state. You meditate, you see yourself as the observer, and eventually you see that there's no observer. That all ideas of self are just are an illusion. So those traditions want to smash and bash. Chindi bindi. Want to chop them up. They want to chop up and pierce and smash and bash any concept of identity at all. So in those traditions, you go to the master and the master says, do the opposite of what you love. That's surrender. Do what you hate. Personal traditions, that is not our understanding. Sometimes people bring that into bhakti. They think, you know, the really surrendered devotee hates the service they're doing. You just think about that for a minute. Okay, I'm trying to love a God who defines surrender by how miserable I am. Sounds to me like a Hitler, you know. Doesn't sound to me like anybody from whom you'd want to have any affection. Anything else? Yes. Doesn't Krishna say Bhagavad Gita what? I'm treating the microphone for the internet people. Yes, well, Krishna says twice, don't do someone else's duties, even if you can do them perfectly. He says to follow another's path is dangerous. He said better to die working according to your own nature than to imitate someone else's nature. I mean, there may be temporary emergencies. Temporary emergencies are always there. That's always the possibility that there's temporary emergencies. But that society shouldn't be run according to temporary emergencies. Yes.
You mentioned on Sunday feast about the verse in Bhagavad Gita where Krishna says that every endeavor is covered by some sort of fault, just
correct,
like fire is covered by smoke.
Yes.
And in this class, you were mentioning how any endeavor that we perform with the conception that I'm a doer,
yes,
is ultimately shreva eva kevalam. This is just a waste of time.
Complete waste of time.
On the other hand, we see here that in the material world, that's the natural tendency of every conditioned soul,
yes,
is to impulsively think that I'm doing everything.
Yes.
So, how can we reconcile these two ideas? Because we can't just give up our duty because we're thinking, sometimes I'm thinking I'm the doer.
Mm.
So it doesn't mean that I should just give up my duty. That's the smoke that's covering the fire.
Mm.
Right? So I should still do my duty. Is it still a waste of time?
Hmm. I think this is coming from the idea that it's an on-off switch instead of a dimmer switch. So you're also pointing up the importance of the training and the study that should happen in the first phase of life. So the training and study that should happen in the first phase of life is not just how can you be a good engineer, how can you be a good doctor, how can you be a good husband and wife and parent. But the training in the first stage of life is how can I work from the platform of egolessness? How can I work as a yogya? That training needs to be there in the first stage of life. And if it's not there, as we see it's not there in modern society, then people really struggle with this. And the idea is that it is gradual. Actually, there's no fault if you're gradually going toward the destination. That's not a fault. If you're traveling from here to San Francisco and you're on the road and the wheels are turning, it's not a fault that you haven't yet reached your destination. It's not a fault at all. That's not what Krishna means by a fault. You're part way on the journey. Again, it's not on-off. We don't have, you know, we don't travel generally by mystic mantra where I just say, San Francisco. Haven't learned how to do that yet. I mean, Prabhupada one time told a reporter, he said that he could travel without an airplane. And the reporter asked him, so why'd you take an airplane? Prabhupada said, to be one with you. You know, but for most of us, our progression from ego-centered to Krishna-centered, as you see in the Madhurya Kadambini, it's a gradual process, where I gradually become more and more Krishna-centered and gradually less and less ego-centered. So as long as one is in that process and making progress, that is not a fault. The fault of our work is that in this material world, it's almost impossible to 100% protect your sources of wealth, 100% protect the fields of wealth, to have your work done in such a way that nobody is ever harmed by anything. It's just almost impossible. You know, like some of these really hardcore vegans were like, we don't want to use anything that has any connection with any animal product. What are you going to do? You have to move away from society. You understand? How are you going to buy anything? How are you going to function? Everything has some kind of contamination. There's some violence and harm. Yes, isn't it? How you cannot move a step. Literally, you cannot take a step without doing some violence to some entity. Like when the Jains, the strict Jains at least, when they build a house, they first find all the creatures that were living in that area and they relocate them. But could you relocate all of them? Hey, the microbes and bacteria are going to relocate you? I mean, can you imagine? You can't. You know, maybe you can relocate the ant colonies and the, you know, mealybug colonies and the lizards and the... But you can't. You're going to build a house, you're destroying someone else's house to build your house. Every living entity is food for another, even if you're vegetarian. You know, there's some harm is happening. Yes? Some level of harm is happening. So in that case, there's smoke covering fire. You're not going to find a way of working in this world where everything is only beneficial to everybody all the time in every way. So in that sense, if you're looking for that kind of an occupation, you won't be able to find it. That doesn't mean, though, that you should take the other extreme and say, well, I'm going to make my money by advertising cigarettes. As I know one devotee is doing. Yes, please.
Thank you. So in the purport, as you're saying, though, there's those who directly engage in a devotional service and then others engaged in foreign ashram. So sometimes people who come to try to surrender in one way or another, they're looking at both categories. Okay, surrendering, you know, to the ashram life or surrendering to, you know, doing my own thing and the farm. So they want to know, is this what your ISKCON is all about? Can I, you know, be under your umbrella as either category, you know, just your strict ashram person, or are you still going to accommodate me as an independent, you know, doing my own thing, trying to be a varnashramite? So they would like to know, is this what your movement is all about? Will you accommodate us all?
Well, we sure better. Because, you know, if you're saying we're only going to accommodate people who fit into the dharma of the life cycle, we're not going to have very many members of our Hare Krishna movement. Frankly, even I would like to suggest that the majority of even our initiated core members do not fully fit into the life cycle dharma of the Shastras. How many people do we have that say, you're really a brahmachari, grahastha, vanaprastha, sannyasi, according to the Shastra? Do we have a lot of those? I'm a perfect grahastha, I'm a perfect sannyasi, according to the descriptions in the Bhagavatam 7th canto of the life cycle dharmas? Forget it. I mean, really, forget it. What did Prabhupada say it is?
Impossible.
Forget it. And there's a lot of people you can't, well, they're not in any ashram. I mean, I remember a devotee from India, only son of his parents, 35 years old, been briefly married, no children, divorced. So he wanted to get initiated, and the temple president said, well, I can't recommend you for initiation because you don't fit into any of the ashrams. He said, you're not in the brahmachari ashram. You're not in the grahastha ashram because you don't have a wife. You're not in the vanaprastha or sannyas ashram because you're working at a job. He says, well, I have to work at a job. He said, my elderly parents are financially dependent on me in India. He said, even if I didn't care about myself, I have to maintain them. Anyway, he said, I'm 35. I don't want to move into the brahmachari ashram. And so it was years. I mean, it was years and years and years. I don't know, like 15 years before the temple authorities finally agreed to recommend him for initiation. And that was only because the temple president changed to a new person. So this kind of thing, it's absurd. You know, a lot of people aren't going to fit anywhere. A lot of people are going to say, what ashram am I in anyway? So I think we can say to people, if you can follow the dharma of the life cycle, that will give you a good foundation for your spiritual life. But if you can't, just chant Hare Krishna anyway. At least follow the four renewed principles. Now, Varna I see is a lot easier than ashram. Ashram I see is just, and it's getting worse and worse and worse and worse and worse. The concepts of what one should do at different stages of the life cycle. It's just, there's such disconnect about between what our scriptures say and our acharyas say what people are doing nowadays. And you almost have no points of connection. It's terrible. And if you preach much about ashram to people in general, they'll just run away. I was just hearing Prabhupada say this in a lecture this morning. He said, he was talking about varnashram. He said, if we talk about varnashram to people, they'll just run away. But I see this is particularly true with ashram. If you tell people, by age 24, 25, you have to make a decision, become a renunciate or get married, and then everybody should... Prabhupada says compulsory, you know, in the first canto. Compulsory marriage by age 24. Younger for women. And then you get married, you have to have kids. Oh my God, you have to have children. So Prabhupada says in this purport, I mean, don't blame me. And you tell people they have to have children. Nobody wants to have children. I have to take care of a child? Oh my God, then I won't be able to just eat and sleep and shop whenever I want. Then I won't be able to have sadhana like a in a monastery. You know, how are you going to do this? And what do you do to people who are divorced? Twice divorced, thrice divorced. When they come to the moon, they're already thrice divorced with kids from each marriage. What are you going to say to them? So you're rejected? What are you going to say to people, they're 68 and they're getting married? What are you going to say to people, they're with sannyas and then they get married? Are we going to reject them? You did the life cycle out of order. You cannot let them chant Hare Krishna. You understand? Yeah, you're going to do that. There you go. How many of us here can say, I have perfectly followed all the lifestyle dharmas exactly in the right order, exactly in the right way? Well, are we going to have like three people in our movement? So, I don't think that's practical. When it comes to varna, I see that as much more practical. So I think with ashram, we talk about principles, and we say to people, these are the principles of ashram, do the best you can, chant Hare Krishna, follow the four related principles. Do some service for the world. As far as varna, I think this is something that we can preach to people in general. I think we can start with that. I see that as the people of, you know, you should, the way you earn your living should be according to your nature. Yes, I want to do that. Here's a way you can work where you could have real meaning in life. Oh yeah, I want to do that. Here's a way you could work so that there'd be ecological harmony. Oh yeah, I want to do that. Here's a way you could work so that there'd be the proper kind of competition within a varna, cooperation between varnas. The whole world would have economic prosperity and all six kinds of wealth would be in abundance in the world. I want to do that. People are excited about that. But if you said to people, oh, you got to regulate your sex life and you got to have kids, and you got, they're going to look at you and go, is there another movement I can join? I don't see it. I personally don't see it. I see varna as something that people are receptive to and we can preach and we can start. It's a way that we can bring bhakti into the world to people who are not ready to, you know, just go on Harinam all day and distribute books and worship the deity all day and who think that we're really weird. I see varna as we could say, hey, these are all things you already want to do. Make it bhakti! But if you try to do it in ashram, that's not something people already want to do. It's not what's going on in the world today. Maybe, you know, 70, 80 years ago, you could have said, hey, you all want a nice house in suburbia with a picket fence and a spouse and kids? Here's how to do it in bhakti. But try saying that to people today. Like, I don't want a house in suburbia with a nice picket fence and a wife and kids. You understand? It's just different, you know. And Prabhupada said, first varna, then ashram. And then bhakti, proper, we can give to everybody, no matter who you are. You can be some, you know, drunk partying out on the street on a Saturday night, we can give you the holy name. We can say, you know, try to find Krishna the taste of your alcohol. Chant Hare Krishna, eat some prasadam. That we can give everybody, I don't care who they are, what they are. They can be Jagannath and Muddai, they can be Magrari the Hunter, they can be a prostitute, it doesn't matter who they are. And they can skip Varna and Ashram in another way. The prostitute who tempted Haridas, she never went through Varna and Ashram, neither did Magrari the Hunter, neither did Jagannath and Muddai. So that's the beauty of bhakti as compared to the other processes of yoga. Hey, just whoever you are, whatever you are, I don't care who you are, what you are, what you're doing. Chad, take some prasadam. Come to the temple, turn the screw for Krishna. Yes,
from your presentation, it sounds like there's no difference between Varnashramtara and Daivi Varnashramtara. There was an idea at one point where I heard there's a difference.
The main difference, as far as what I understand, is that demoniac Varnashram is done by birth and not by qualification. So if you look at places, particularly where Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati is talking about Daivi Varnashram, he says it's by one's... Am I correct? Yes? That Daivi Varnashram is by your intrinsic nature, and Rakshasa Varnashram, you know, demoniac Varnashram, is, it's a, you know, you have to have the occupation of your family. And that must be the last one.
Just very quickly, this was in response to the question about the doer. So just tying in what you had said on Sunday about agency. So we do have agency as long as we're in connection with the Supreme.
Oh, excellent.
So, then that is an impetus to continue doing. We're spiritualizing our duty, not abandoning it.
Thank you so much for bringing that up. That's very important. Do you understand that point? No. Okay, so when you actually are working on the transcendent platform, where it's a platform of a real absolute increase rather than just equal and opposite reaction, shifting around the modes of nature, then you really are a doer. You really have agency. You are a doer that because of you, something is existing that wasn't existing before and will exist eternally. So that we want to change from the false concept of doership and illusion to real doership and transcendence rather than negating doership. Thank you so much for bringing that up. Thank you for... Anybody? Something? Yes. Oh, I would love to hear from you, Maharaj. Are you sure? Thank you so much for setting such a wonderful example, Maharaj. And I apologize that I've been on a writing retreat and so I've been mostly hiding while I've been here. I've been living in a cave. I hope you excuse me. And thank you so... What? A very beautiful cave.